KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Something told me to take a picture, because this might be the last time we see it.
Among the things destroyed by the LA wildfires, the historic ranch house of cowboy and movie star Will Rogers.
It's Friday, January 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, our co-host, Elsa Chang, went to see what's left of the Will Rogers estate.
Also, how small business owners are preparing for the TikTok ban. Thousands rely on the app for income.
It levels the playing field compared to bigger corporations that have large marketing budgets.
And newcomers to America tell their stories for our series, Seeking Common Ground.
Today, we visit a Latino community in Kansas City.
We're the workers, right? We're a blue-collar community. So I feel like there's a lot of hesitance to come to our community because they know once they see us as people, they would have to treat us better.
We'll have those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration events are moving indoors due to frigid weather forecasts. Trump announced the changes on his social media platform. More from NPR's Lexi Schapitl.
Trump announced on social media that his inaugural address, prayers, and other speeches will take place in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, citing, quote, dangerous conditions. The events will be live-streamed at Capital One Arena in downtown D.C., and Trump will visit the arena after his swearing in. The announcement comes as local forecasters predict Monday could bring freezing temperatures and single-digit wind chills. It's expected to be the coldest inauguration in 40 years. The last time an inauguration was moved inside due to weather was 1985. For Ronald Reagan's second inaugural. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court has left TikTok on track to be banned as of Sunday. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, justices found TikTokers' free expression does not supersede what the court calls well-supported national security concerns that derive from the app's relationship with a foreign adversary.
The court ruled that Congress acted lawfully when it voted to shut down TikTok if the app didn't shed its China-based owner. The ruling represents the culmination of years of concern about the hit video-sharing app and the most serious threat to the app's existence in the U.S. It's unclear what TikTok might do come Sunday. It may hit the kill switch on its server, or not. The incoming Trump administration has indicated that immediate enforcement of the law may not be coming. That might be cold comfort to Apple and Google, which could face billions of dollars in penalties if they ignore the law. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
A fire at one of the country's largest battery energy storage facilities on California's sensitive Central Coast has local officials calling on the industry to do better. Amy Mayer of member station KAZU has the story.
The fire broke out Thursday afternoon at Vista Corporation's Moss Landing Energy Storage Facility. The new technology feeds the power grid with energy stored in batteries. When some of those caught fire, officials evacuated 1,200 people and advised residents to stay indoors amid fears of potentially toxic smoke. Monterey County Supervisor Glenn Church says the industry needs to close gaps in safety and planning.
This is really a three-mile island event for this industry. If renewable energy is going to be a future, it really needs to rest on safe energy.
The company said Friday morning their preliminary air monitoring data indicate no hazardous chemicals. For NPR News, I'm Amy Mayer.
The nation's pool of red ink is showing no signs of shrinking. In fact, it's expected over the next decade, the national debt will rise by $23.9 trillion, a sum that does not include trillions of dollars worth of tax cuts being pushed by President-elect Donald Trump. The eye-popping number comes from the Congressional Budget Office, which today released its 10-year budget forecast. Stocks on Wall Street closed higher today. The Dow was up 334 points. You're listening to NPR. The head of the Internal Revenue Service, Danny Werfel, says he'll step down from his position on Inauguration Day. The move is an unusual one since IRS heads generally are extended from one administration to the next. Werfel's term was not set to end until November of 2027. However, President-elect Donald Trump had already announced his plan to nominate a new IRS commissioner. Russia and Iran are formalizing closer ties in the face of Western pressure and sanctions. At a ceremony today in Moscow, leaders of both countries signed a new cooperation agreement. NPR's Charles Maines reports from the Russian capital.
They call it the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Treaty. It deepens Russian-Iranian ties in a range of areas, most notably in trade and defense. In a ceremony at the Kremlin, Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian and Russian President Vladimir Putin both praised the agreement as the next step in their country's budding relations. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Western intelligence agencies say the Kremlin has increasingly turned to Iran for drones and missiles to launch attacks on its neighbor. The pact's signing comes just days before President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House, pledging to increase pressure on Iran and negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine, timing the Kremlin dismisses as mere coincidence. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Add the popular weight loss drugs Ozempic and Wegovy to the list of medicines whose prices will be negotiated by the government under Medicare. The new price negotiations would be handled by the incoming administration. The upshot for consumers could be billions in savings. Drug companies oppose the program, though, saying it, quote, fails to address the two challenges facing seniors and Medicare. Ozempic and Wegovy are made by Denmark-based Novo Nordisk. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Ailsa Chang in Los Angeles, where a lot of people are still replaying exactly where they were last Tuesday when the Palisades fire began roaring through the mountains here. Like Barbara Tejada, who was speeding down the Pacific Coast Highway.
I threw on the hazard lights and we kind of upset a few people probably, but we were driving on the shoulder of the road so that we could get here.
Here. As in the historic ranch home of Will Rogers, the vaudeville performer and radio and movie star. He was known as America's cowboy philosopher. And last week, as smoke billowed in the hills just beyond his ranch, park officials like Tejada jumped into action.
We pulled up trucks right here where we're standing right on the lawn.
Uh-huh. You dashed into the house. What was your first room?
The main living room. We have a lot of Charles Russell bronze sculptures. There were some key things owned by Will, like his, you know, his boots, his typewriter. And people are packing. We're moving things into trucks.
And you keep spinning around and looking out the windows.
Yes. And at one point I came out and I literally saw the smoke plume start to churn. And that was the clue. Like, I realized, okay, guys, whatever you have in your hands,
we're
that's it. We've got to go. Like, this is the last round of things. We've got to go.
They hopped into their trucks. And before they left, Tejada took one last look at the house.
And something told me to take a picture because this might be the last time we see it. Mm. So I did take I do have a photo from the truck.
Oh my God.
The ranch house is right
there. The sky's just lit orange, red,
yes.
Yellow, gray. It looks like a watercolor.
Yeah. If you didn't know how destructive it was, it'd be beautiful.
This ranch house is the centerpiece of the Will Rogers State Historic Park, a vast stretch of natural space in the Santa Monica Mountains. It's a treasure to Angelenos. People get married here. They picnic here, have kids' birthday parties on the Great Lawn. There's a huge network of trails that snake up into the hills, packed with hikers and bikers. The ranch house itself has survived a near miss with wildfire before, but this time it wasn't so lucky.
What went through your mind when you saw what we're staring at now? These charred remains, these lone chimneys sticking up into the sky with nothing around them.
I was taking deep breaths to not have a panic attack. And I was just, it's gone. I can't believe it's gone.
This house that has stood here for nearly a century is now a pile of rubble surrounded by yellow police tape.
those stone steps, that was the entrance.
Yeah.
So that right there is, you know, you see the bathtub. That was actually on the second story. There's
the bathtub's now right behind the fireplace in the main room.
Exactly.
Tejada then leads us across the Great Lawn, the only thing that's still green around here.
There's little burn marks here and there from embers.
And we go past the destroyed horse stables to meet Richard Fink, who helps manage the state parks in this area.
So if you were to come here on weekend days, you're typically going to see a line of cars eager to get in.
He guides us towards the Inspiration Loop Trail, which was one of the most popular hikes in this park. Now, it's completely empty.
It's very surreal. You know, probably never see anything like this again, and it's devastating.
Oh, wow, Richard. I've hiked these trails many times, and this is just completely different. It's black. I mean, the only plant life are these blackened twigs jutting out of the ground, these skinny skeletal tree trunks. It's kind of spooky.
It's spooky, and you know, if you get up to the top of the Inspiration Loop at Inspiration Point, every hillside that you look at from around the park here looks exactly the same.
And yet, we suddenly notice small traces of what used to be, a few singed pieces of paper poking up from the eucalyptus leaves.
I just found this page on the ground for Julian's chili.
It was a Will Rogers cookbook. Here's the a recipe from the governor of Oklahoma for carrot pineapple cake.
Well, I'll give this to you if you're going to assemble the recipe book again.
Yeah.
It does make you think what nature was thinking when it decided what to save and what to destroy.
Right.
Still standing next to the ruins of the ranch house is a majestic oak tree where I meet Armando Quintero, the director of the California Department of Parks and Recreation. And I ask him what these fires have done to the relationship between Angelenos and all the nature that surrounds them.
It's an answer full of emotion. You know, these places offer restoration for us as individuals, for families to gather. They're places of memory. And I mean, this is literally a disaster of memory for so many.
I mean, I'm also just thinking about people in Southern California who may not have a home with a big yard, who can flock to a big space like this and feel for a moment that they live in a beautiful corner of Los Angeles.
Exactly. This is the home of Angelenos. It's the home of Californians.
Can you even begin to describe the psychic injury that has been inflicted on people who have used outdoor space as solace and are now looking at the charred remains of what used to be an incredibly beautiful park?
You can see me. It's overwhelming grief. And being the director of a department with all these employees and the public, and the responsibility is one of, how do we care? Literally, it's about caring. This work is caring for each other, caring for our homes, and strengthening what makes us human. I'm heartbroken.
But as painful as this time is, Quintero says, listen. You can hear the birds. They're back. And look, he says, the deer. They're wandering back.
Too. Oh, there's a deer right now.
Oh, yeah. I do. A lone deer just walking tentatively into the stable. Oh, yeah, there's another.
We see them walking in the abandoned horse pasture.
Nature does
come back.
Continue.
What does that feel like to you to watch the deer come back?
Hopeful. Life goes on.
Things will return.
Yeah.
A small reminder that nature ultimately is resilient and that this beautiful park will come back one day.
The ban on TikTok is set to take effect this weekend.
Today, the Supreme Court voted to uphold the federal government's ban, which would mean that for millions of Americans, the app could go dark.
Some of those Americans use TikTok for their small businesses, relying heavily on it for sales that didn't exist before.
7 million businesses in our country that rely upon the platform.
That's Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts earlier this week urging a delay to the ban. The business owners he's talking about are people like Morgan Gillentine, who promote or sell their products in the app.
Being a small business owner, it's hard enough on its own, and then just to have the rug pulled out from under you. We have other platforms, but just no other platform gives you the reach that TikTok does.
Gillentine started a lotion company with her dad in 2008. She says TikTok transformed their business.
In just a few short months, we've sold over 20,000 bottles of lotion and reached such a wide community that we would have never reached without a platform like TikTok. I would say probably about 60 to 70% of our sales are from TikTok Shop.
Gillentine has been migrating her existing content to Facebook and Instagram ahead of the ban, but she says it won't be the same.
Alex Blomstrom feels the same way. She uses TikTok to promote her clothing brand.
The overall feel of those platforms isn't the same as TikTok. And as much as I would love to say that my customers are going to be able to pick up seamlessly with TikTok gone, I just don't see the same kind of reach and the same consistent reach on an app like Instagram.
Blomstrom says more than anything, TikTok makes advertising accessible. She says it levels the playing field for small business owners.
Compared to bigger corporations that have large marketing budgets that are able to invest in ad spend across multiple social media platforms.
But people who support the ban, like Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, point to national security concerns with the app.
TikTok isn't just another social media platform. TikTok is a Chinese communist spy app that addicts our kids, harvests their data, targets them with harmful and manipulative content, and spreads communist propaganda.
President-elect Trump, who takes office a day after the ban is scheduled to go into effect, says he may direct his administration not to enforce it or even push back its start date.
Which leaves small business owners like Gillentine and Blomstrom still watching the clock. TikTok. For lucky folks who happen to be in London and not able to sleep on this starry night, you might want to head over to the National Gallery. The Van Gogh exhibit there is in its final weekend. It is staying open 24 hours all night to give everyone a chance to take it in.
This is the gallery's first exhibit dedicated to Van Gogh. It features more than 60 works that have been gathered from galleries and private collections around the world.
The exhibit will also feature one of Van Gogh's iconic self-portraits. He painted some 36 of them throughout his career. Not because of vanity. A lot of the portraits were completed while he was in France and was broke and struggling to find models. So he chose the simplest solution and voila, painted himself.
This is only the second time the National Gallery is leaving the museum open all night due to high demand. The last time was for an exhibit of works by Leonardo da Vinci.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For our series, Seeking Common Ground, reporters around the U.S. have been sitting down to talk with all sorts of people, including immigrants and second-generation Americans whose parents immigrated here. These conversations reveal a sort of timeline of the immigrant experience, how people settle in, how their needs change, and what it takes to feel like you really belong. In the next few minutes, we will hear three different stories that are part of this series. The first comes from Stephanie Rivera at Colorado Public Radio.
Last fall, in Aurora, Colorado, I met a family, a mom, a dad, and six kids. It was their first 24 hours in the state. They had just arrived after an eight-month journey from Colombia.
O sea, es muy bonito Colombia, donde yo vivo es bonito, pero por ese lado es muy defectuoso. Matan mucha gente.
The mother, Elisa, says Colombia is beautiful. But it has problems. Local cartels and armed groups controlled people's lives, and they killed people indiscriminately. She says they threatened her children.
Entonces, pues, ya cuando comenzaron con mis hijos, ya amenazarlos, todo eso, ya me tocó, pues, de decir que emigremos para acá, Estados Unidos.
And that's when they decided to immigrate to the U.S., to seek asylum. On their journey, they say they faced harassment and robbery, and they ended up in Aurora, a suburb of Denver, at a rundown apartment complex. A fellow migrant had recommended they might find temporary housing there.
Llegamos y bien recibidos, sí. Solo nos abrieron la puerta y bueno, ahí pueden descansar.
The husband, Luis, says they were welcomed when they arrived. Someone opened the door and said, "You can rest here." The family of eight was ushered into a vacant apartment unit. It had no electricity, gas, or hot water. This is not just any apartment complex. It's a place that became the focus of national attention last year. President-elect Donald Trump claimed it had been taken over by a Venezuelan gang. He also claimed the whole city of Aurora had been taken over. This is not true. What is true is that a lot of new immigrants live in this apartment complex in terrible conditions, and there has been criminal activity there. That's one of the reasons that Elisa and Luis spoke to us on condition that we'd only use their first names, to protect them from being targeted.
Que no se puede dormir. Porque esas cucarachas y el frío, esas ventanas dañadas, entra un frío. Y ya nosotros no dormimos toda la noche.
On their first night, they hardly slept due to the cold. Temperatures dropped to the 30s. There was loud partying outside and roaches running around inside. Elisa and Luis hope the U.S. will grant them asylum. They say they have a court date in November. But when I met them, what they needed most was a meal and a place to live. At the apartment complex, Luis says he was told,
ustedes pueden quedarse por unos días, 15 días, o hasta que busquen un hogar.
You can stay for a few days, 15 days, or until you look for a home. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Rivera.
And I'm Zach Perez from KCUR in Kansas City. Just like Stephanie, I spoke with a group of Latino immigrants, though the group I gathered was a bit more established in the U.S.
I'm Myra Romero Furman. I've lived in Wyandotte County since 1996.
My name is Alba Lopez. I've been here since 2003.
Alba, Myra, and two others who joined us, Luis Gonzalez and Edgar Galicia, are members of a large working-class Latino community in Kansas City, Kansas. Galicia tells me that work brought his parents to the area in the 1980s, and they put down roots.
They really enjoy the ability to invest and the ability to grow in the community that was shaping up at the time.
This group says that Latino immigrants brought this part of Kansas City, Kansas back to life. They say they boosted the city's falling population and opened businesses in areas that had been plagued by urban blight for decades. And they're proud of it. Here's Myra Romero Furman.
I think there is a lot of misinformation about how much economic growth and opportunity we've been able to build on Central Avenue, thanks to leaders like Edgar and all of our Hispanic entrepreneurs that have really come in and saved our county.
Que no nos dan el mismo valor que las demás personas. Era lo que yo decía.
They say they're looked down on by local officials and other residents. Here's Luis Gonzalez.
We don't fight. We don't. They don't listen to us. They don't watch us. They're just passive and don't see us.
Like, we're the workers, right? We're a blue-collar community. So I feel like there's a lot of hesitance to come to our community because they know once they see us as people, they would have to treat us better.
Everyone in this group has legal status in this country, but they say stigmas of poverty and crime stick to their community, even as they've turned blocks of abandoned houses into rows of quaint single-family homes. Despite that, or perhaps because of it, the group feels extremely connected to one another.
For me, it's united. That's the only word that comes on my mind, because everybody, it's like supporting each other.
Yeah, like we're all advocates in the Hispanic community because we don't have a choice, you know? It's life or death.
Yes.
Or deportation.
For NPR News, I'm Zach Perez in Kansas City.
And I'm LaToya Dennis from Central Florida Public Media. I spoke to a group of first and second generation immigrants in Orlando. Unlike Zach and Stephanie's group, the women I talked to have been here since childhood or even their entire lives. They are part of a local organization for Muslim women. When we talked, they got pretty quickly to the question, how long does it take, really, to be considered an American?
And I came here when I was very little, so I'm a native to Central Florida.
That's Sadia Qureshi. She was born in Pakistan and lived in Florida for about 40 years. Fatima Sadaf Saeed was born here.
My only home has ever been Florida. And to be treated like it's not that way, it's difficult, you know?
The women in this group wear hijab, headscarves. Saeed told a story about a time when she took part in an interfaith event.
It was like Oprah style, where I'm sitting with somebody who's like interviewing me and we're having a conversation. And the questions this woman asked me, she's like, what kind of food do you eat? And I was like, pizza? Like, what games do you like to play? I was like, Scrabble, football, I don't know. I didn't know what she wanted me to say.
That laughter, it's a language of disbelief and also understanding.
I feel that a lot, just that there's an assumption that you're foreign, that you're not from here, when really this is all that I've ever known.
Qureshi says her children, two generations removed from Pakistan, deal with the same struggles.
You can't shed off that identity, right? Because it's your skin color, your scarf. And we felt like we didn't belong because of our parents, right?
Yeah.
We thought our kids would feel like they would belong more, and I don't think they get that.
This group of women includes a doctor, a PhD student, and a product manager for a Fortune 500 company. So by some measures, they are living the American dream, even if not everyone considers them American. For NPR News, I'm LaToya Dennis in Orlando.
And you've also heard reports there by Zach Perez of KCUR in Kansas City and Stephanie Rivera with Colorado Public Radio. Our series, Seeking Common Ground, is part of a partnership with Cortico. That's a nonprofit that uses AI tools to spot patterns in conversations. In keeping with NPR policy, AI played no role in the writing or editing of the stories you just heard.
This is NPR News.
It's award season, and that means high-profile Hollywood actors taking star turns in biopics.
When you're making a movie about Abraham Lincoln, or you're making a movie about Leonard Bernstein, like, there's an air of importance around these movies, right? You have to take this history seriously.
We look at why biopics are perennial Oscar bait and what makes them good or bad. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, if you associate the pipe organ with musty churches,
the new album Dreamcatcher is here to help you change your mind.
Dreamcatcher is a smartly curated album where a thoughtful artist challenges us to think of the organ as an instrument of our time.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The widely popular social media app TikTok is just 2 days away from being banned in the United States. The Supreme Court has upheld a bipartisan law that requires TikTok's China-based parent company to divest by Sunday or cease to operate in the country. Carl Tobias, a law professor at the University of Richmond, says incoming President Donald Trump has a number of options to keep the app running.
Once he's in office and has been inaugurated, issue an executive order, and the most effective way for him to do that would be to follow the statute and seek a 60 or 90 day extension.
In a statement issued just a short time ago, TikTok said unless the Biden administration immediately provides a definitive statement to satisfy the most critical service providers assuring non-enforcement, TikTok will be forced to go dark on January 19th. A former CIA analyst has pleaded guilty to leaking classified information related to Israeli plans to attack Iran. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The 34-year-old pleaded guilty to 2 counts of willful retention and transmission of classified national defense information. Asif William Rahman leaked 2 top-secret documents that contained classified information about Israeli preparations to attack Iran. At the time of the leak, Israel's intention to conduct military strikes was well known, and it did later hit Iran with airstrikes. Court papers say the former CIA analyst took steps to cover his tracks, including deleting journal entries and destroying his cell phone and an internet router he used to send photos of classified documents. Rahman faces up to 10 years in prison for both counts. He's scheduled to be sentenced in May. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Syria's interim government says there are no more excuses for Israeli soldiers to be patrolling a buffer zone between the two countries. The new head of state is calling for international pressure to get Israel's military to leave. NPR's Carrie Khan reports from Damascus.
Syria's interim leader Ahmad al-Shara says Israel's past reasons to remain in Syria no longer hold. At first, the reason given, he says, was to stop Iranian militias. But he says, quote, since the liberation of Damascus, this excuse no longer holds. Qatari officials visiting Syria called for Israel's immediate withdrawal. The UN has patrolled a thin buffer zone between Israel and Syria for decades. After the fall of the Assad regime, Israel moved into the buffer zone, saying the move was to safeguard Israel's security. It has remained there despite criticism and protests from local residents in Arab countries. Last Wednesday, Israel struck a target inside Syria, killing 3 people, according to a Human Rights War Monitor group. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Damascus.
Large parts of the United States are preparing for an Arctic blast over the next several days. Forecasters say Arctic air is plunging across the Rockies and Great Plains and will reach the Deep South and Great Lakes by Saturday night. The cold air will reach parts of the East Coast by Sunday night, bringing wind chill temperatures in the single digits. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Paramount Pictures, presenting the new film September 5, When gunshots are heard in the Olympic Village, broadcast history is made, and the whole world is watching. Based on a true story, now playing. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. His first time in office, Donald Trump tried to scale back federal food aid. Now his allies aim to try again as they look to cut government spending. Meanwhile, food banks around the country say they are busier than ever, and they're bracing for even more demand. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
At the No Limits food pantry outside Washington, D.C., the line stretches to the street and down the block.
For everybody, back up, please.
People show up hours before the door opens, even on frigid days like this.
Now I'm losing feeling out of my toes.
Ted Wiles gets by on Social Security, plus a small pension from the decade he worked a union job at a plant. He started coming to this pantry in Maryland a few years ago when food prices skyrocketed.
If it wasn't for this particular place, you know, I'd probably have to dig a little deeper. This has saved me immensely.
Farther back in line, Danya Godbolt says it's her second time here.
Short on food stamps, so I need to put some food in my house.
She says several hundred dollars a month in federal food aid only lasts 2.5 weeks for her and her husband. He had his leg amputated from diabetes. She quit work to care for him. Without the help, she says they'd be hungry.
We wouldn't have any food other than, you know, family members assisting or making meals.
More than 1 in 10 people in this country get federal food aid, and food insecurity has kept rising because of things like inflation and the end of pandemic aid. Radha Muthaya heads the Capital Area Food Bank, which surveyed people in the Washington, D.C. region. She was surprised to see the biggest bump in need was among households with income over $100,000.
Those who are increasingly educated and those who are increasingly earning higher levels of income, just not enough to meet the cost of living in our area.
For all the good her food bank does, Mathia says the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is crucial.
For every one meal that a food bank provides, the SNAP program provides 9.
But SNAP's size and budget makes it a target for cuts. The first Trump administration tried to tighten rules and limit who qualifies for SNAP. It was blocked by Congress and the courts, but Trump allies want to try again. Angela Rashidi with the Center-Right American Enterprise Institute says the program is no longer focused on those most in need.
It's kind of become too large, a little bit unruly, and Congress may need to step in and kind of rein it in.
For example, right now, states can raise the income limit for recipients. Supporters say that helps people who work but face other large expenses like childcare. States can also waive work requirements for certain people, which can give them more time to find a better job. But Rashidi and others argue that states are too quick to do both those things. And simply expanding aid, she says, does not solve the real problem.
It's not just about cutting these programs. It's about helping people get on a path so they can work and provide for their own family so they don't need these programs.
Back in Maryland at No Limits Food Pantry, a woman leads the volunteers in prayer.
Amen.
And the door finally opens. People file by long tables, filling bags and pull carts with apples, frozen fish, pasta, and chicken breasts.
There you go. You have a good day.
Thank you.
Some days there's so many people, the pantry cuts off the line before food runs out. Oliver Carter, the senior pastor who heads the pantry, worries demand will spike if people lose SNAP benefits.
How would they compensate for that? They're going to try to get free food.
His budget is already stretched so thin, he says, he almost had to shut down last year.
People think it's cheap to run a food bank, but when you look at the freezers, the refrigerators, the electric bill, the rent for the building, it's a hard work that we're doing.
But he'll be here to help, he says, however many people may show up in need. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Landover, Maryland.
Super Bowl Sunday is less than a month away, and a team considered one of the worst in the NFL for decades might qualify for the first time, the Detroit Lions. Not only that, there are predictions the Lions could win the big game. They'll have to get through Saturday's playoff against the Washington Commanders first. In the meantime, the mere possibility that the Lions could hoist the Super Bowl trophy is helping Detroit fans restore their roar. Quinn Kleinfelter from member station WDET reports.
The excitement in and around Detroit is palpable. It's evident in the line of hundreds of people outside the Home Bakery in suburban Rochester. They've come to see a huge cake in the bakery's window, a life-sized replica of Detroit Lions receiver Amon-Ra St. Brown doing a headstand touchdown celebration, and for a chance to win scarce playoff tickets donated by the player. Rob Dalton and his wife took the day off work and drove over an hour to join the line.
More than just watching them win, it's just watching all of our fans just be so giddy about what's going on with our team. It's been a long time since we've had a team that's looked like it could contend, and now we're like the favorites, and I don't even know if we know how to take it right now.
Nearby, Kina Benning-Denke touches up her Honolulu blue lipstick, one of the Lions' team colors. She says she and her husband are 38-year season ticket holders and showed up for more than cake and passes to a game.
Because it's fun! And the whole atmosphere and the buzz around the whole team winning, and it's an exciting time to be a Lions fan.
Because we've waited so long for it. I think it means more to us as fans, as losers, so long, we deserve it.
Bakery owner Heather Toko says people have lined up for days around the shop. She says her football player cake is just one slice of the millions of dollars in economic impact the Lions playoff run has brought to Metro Detroit.
We are looking to drive some revenue for January sales because typically I have to lay off people and cut their hours. I would not have imagined in a million years that I would have a two-hour wait to get into this building to purchase a baked good.
It's a fervor that's reached even senior citizen homes in the region, with some spreading their enthusiasm on TV. About a half dozen burly, goateed men dressed to look like Lions head coach Dan Campbell led a pep rally at the Jewish Senior Life of Metropolitan Detroit. 81-year-old Mike Schlissel remembers helping console Lions players following yet another defeat at a bar he frequented in the 1960s.
And they came in right after the game. They were willing to talk to you even though they lost. All you could say to them was, "We'll get it. We'll get it." And now we got it. It's been a long time coming.
These days, the Lions excite fans with a steady string of wins and the aggressive actions of colorful coach Campbell. During his tenure, Campbell's had the Lions offense go for it on fourth down rather than kick it to the opponent more than any other NFL team. And Campbell says Detroit's recent rise from league doormats has the team ready for whatever happens on the football field.
We've been so good. We've been so bad. We're a laughing stock. Now we're great. And it's just been this roller coaster of up and downs. And this is nothing new that we're in. We're in the middle of the circus, man. And it's about time to perform.
Now Campbell and the Lions are just a few wins away from what once seemed almost impossible, an elusive Super Bowl victory. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Netflix put another notch in its belt for live sports this month with the debut of World Wrestling Entertainment's flagship cable program. Our colleagues from the Indicator podcast, Adrian Ma and Darian Woods, explain what this means for the future of live sports on television.
You may have heard in recent years about a trend called cord cutting. That's where customers increasingly abandon their cable TV subscriptions in favor of getting their content in other places, like streaming.
And in a sense, cord cutting is what World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE, is doing with one of its longest-running programs called Monday Night Raw. Because for the first time, it went live on Netflix. WWE and Netflix promoted the heck out of it.
Welcome to Raw on Netflix.
This is part of a $5 billion deal where Netflix agreed to pay WWE for exclusive rights to the show for the next decade. And it's not the only live sports deal Netflix has struck. It's also secured rights to stream National Football League games and the Women's World Cup. So why would Netflix pay billions of dollars for this content when it already has its own massive machine for generating movies and TV series? We put that question to Paolo Pescatore. He tracks media and telecom companies for an analyst firm called PP Foresight.
I think for Netflix, they need to diversify. They can't just solely rely on one genre, say, or just on-demand programming.
Paolo says Netflix is the global leader in streaming right now. And according to the company's third quarter earnings report, it has about 282 million subscribers around the globe. But for Netflix, getting rights to stream live sports is about keeping its competitive edge. Thing is, Paolo says that this is easier said than done.
You know, it's not just about acquiring those rights. Perhaps more important is ensuring that you have reliable infrastructure to deliver those streams at scale.
The difficulty of streaming a live event around the world became clear when Netflix ran a boxing match between Jake Paul and Mike Tyson in November. Many of the tens of millions of people who tuned in were hit with lots and lots of buffering.
Still, Netflix's early forays into live sports seemed to be successful at attracting viewers. For example, last month, Netflix for the first time streamed two NFL games live on Christmas Day. And each of those games drew about 14 million viewers, making it the most watched English language programs on Netflix that week.
The way things are shaping up, Paolo predicts this content war between streamers and old school cable and broadcast networks will continue. And in the future, some may look very different, changing business models or merging with other companies.
One thing for sure, he says, is that the ones who survive will be looking for ways to offer their content online. And in fact, we're already seeing some old school cable and broadcast providers distributing their content over the internet.
Will we ever see the Super Bowl being streamed over a streamer over the next 5 years? Most likely not, but certainly in the 2030s, we will get to see a big global sporting event being exclusively available over the internet.
Darian, if you could see any big sports competition on Netflix, what would you want to see?
Competitive game theory, maybe?
Adrian Ma,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In 3 days, President-elect Donald Trump will take office, and he has promised to carry out mass deportations of people in the U.S. without legal status. Immigrants are bracing for Trump's actions. Some say they'll stop going to work. And advocacy organizations say they are ready to challenge Trump in court and to provide legal help to those detained. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
There's a real fear in the immigrant community. You can ask Nicolas, a 20-year-old restaurant worker who comes from South America and is in the U.S. without legal status.
Mucho más allá de las redadas es la forma en las que se va a hacer y cómo se van a respetar los derechos de las personas.
Nicolas says he's not only worried about the workplace raids that can occur across the country, but also about the way they will be conducted. He fears rights will be violated. Nicolas is also an organizer with Resistencia en Acción, which advocates for immigrant rights and the working class in New Jersey. We're only using his middle name because he worries about being targeted for his immigration status. When Trump gets inaugurated on Monday, Nicolas says he won't be at the restaurant where he works.
Por tanta ataque que se ha venido contra nosotros y por tantas cosas que sabemos que pueden suceder.
He says he made that decision in part out of fear of being caught up in a raid.
Pero yo voy a ir a asistir a una marcha donde la comunidad migrante se va a unir.
Instead, he will be at a rally in Newark, hosted by immigrant rights groups, to send a message that there are people willing to stand up and fight. It's unclear what actions Trump will take to target people who are living in the U.S. without legal status in his first days or weeks in office. The Republican has said he will start mass deportations on day one. He's also vowed to end birthright citizenship. According to an NPR PBS News Marist poll released this week, 49% of Americans back mass deportations. A spokesperson for Trump's transition team told NPR in a statement that he will deliver on his promises, although she didn't answer a question about whether all of this would happen right away.
We are prepared to meet the impending Trump administration head on.
That's Felicia Gomez, a senior policy advocate at the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties.
We will use every tool in our toolbox to defend civil rights and liberties of all people in our region.
The ACLU has been preparing plans for different scenarios. They include offering Know Your Rights training for migrants in different languages. It's also putting in teams to rapidly respond to the raids. But Trump's promises are not the only reason why immigrant communities are on edge. Under the Biden administration, which deported a record number of migrants since 2014, many haven't felt safe. Last week, Customs and Border Protection conducted arrests in California's Central Valley. According to CBP, 78 migrants without legal status were detained during the three-day operation. The agency says those arrested had broken the law. Mario Gonzalez is the deputy director of Centro La Familia Advocacy Services in Fresno, California.
Over the weekend and days after, people were not coming out. People were not leaving their homes. People were staying at home.
He says his organization has been receiving nonstop calls from people asking what they can do to protect themselves. Employers have also gotten involved.
Again, this is something new as well. Not something that we saw a lot of prior to this. But this time around, we're seeing employers actually reach out ahead of time and ask for us to show up and to do Know Your Rights trainings to their employees.
He says this is a sign of how some employers see the value of the immigrant workforce, one that could be decimated if mass deportations were to take place. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Washington.
There's at least one piece of organ music many of us have heard, right? Bach's famous Toccata and Fugue in D minor. The pipe organ tends to be thought of as a fusty relic of classical music, but NPR's Tom Heisinger wants to change your mind about the instrument with help from a new album by organist James McVinney.
Pity the poor pipe organ, heard only in churches, vintage horror movies, and increasingly fewer baseball stadiums. British keyboardist James McVinney, with his new album Dreamcatcher, wants you to hear the instrument in fresh new ways and in new compositions. That's McVinney playing Patterns by Nico Muhly, a composer still in his early 40s. beside agile fingers and fleet feet, pipe organ playing is a lot about registration, the fine art of capturing unique sonorities by choosing the right combination of pipes. Like in Riff Raff, a whimsical piece by Giles Swain that, as they say, pulls out all the stops. Even the peculiar ones. We're hearing the grand organ at St. Albans Cathedral, north of London. That's where McVinnie served as an organist in his teens, and that's where he returned to record this album. The instrument boasts 4,500 pipes, enough to give heft to a little boogie-woogie. You can't live on organ music alone, and neither does McVinnie, which is why he also included contemporary piano pieces on the album, like the oddly titled Imaginary Pancake by Gabriella Smith, a young composer from California. The music is obsessed with the two extremes of the keyboard, arms outstretched to the lowest and highest keys. Oh, and there's some delicious pounding. As a pianist, McVinnie has an organist's ear for color. In China Gates, an early work by John Adams, the constant yet gentle San Francisco rain that inspired the composer is rendered in crystalline detail as McVinnie spotlights the descending droplets. Adams is just one of nine living composers on the album, including Laurie Spiegel, a pioneering electronic composer whose piece, The Unquestioned Answer, gets a pipe organ makeover by McVinnie. He's fascinated with the connections between his instrument and its high-tech descendant, the synthesizer. Here, the droning and tolling sound of the pipe organ becomes a dazzling stand-in for modern electronics. James McVinnie's Dreamcatcher is a smartly curated album where a thoughtful artist challenges us, with extraordinary results, to think of the organ as an instrument of our time.
The album is Dreamcatcher by James McVinnie. Our reviewer is NPR's Tom Heisinga.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Sony Pictures Classics with The Room Next Door, starring Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton. After years apart, two friends meet again in an extreme situation, directed by Pedro Almodovar, now playing only in theaters. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12.